Very nice. Thank you very much for this special music and also for the first split sermon this morning, too. So, and welcome to everyone here, guests and visitors. I see someone in the back there and anyone else who's listening online. Welcome and happy Sabbath to all of you. Well, my message ties in pretty much with the first one, kind of a continuation of it or extension of it. As we approach the Passover season, we are again examining ourselves, or we will be, and it may be that we'll find much improvement in our lives, or many things we've improved upon or overcome, or sometimes just having been able to get through some tough situations is rewarding. But more likely, though, we tend to focus on the negative side, if you're like me anyway. We see the things that didn't go well, or areas where we did the wrong thing or didn't do the right thing. And it can be very discouraging to us to look at what we call our failures. But in this message today, I'd like to take a look at failure in our lives, whether it's real or perceived, because what we perceive as failure isn't always a failure. And I want to help us approach it with a more positive attitude, and hence the title of the message, Failing Successfully. A success and failure can't necessarily be evaluated in this physical lifetime. Many people that we commonly view of today as having been successful died believing that they have failed in life. And if you go online and search for a list of such people, you'll find the list with headings such as people who became famous posthumously, or cultural giants who died coinless, or other searches, and you'll find that many of the people that we do consider famous, whom we consider successes, would have thought that they were failures in their own lifetimes. And there are lists of people, scientists, Galileo, for example, or Gregor Mendel, artists such as El Greco and Vermeer, musicians, Franz Schubert, or Stephen Foster, or even J.S. Bach. Bach was widely known as an organist, but it really wasn't until the early 1800s that his music caught on, and he had died in 1750. How about authors? Henry David Thoreau, Edgar Allan Poe, Emily Dickinson, they were all failures until after they had died. Stieg Larsson, the author of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and the other books of that series, all of those were published after his death. Consider Anne Frank. In her eyes, she was just a young girl. Nothing special about her, but she kept a diary. And the diary that was first in English was first published as Diary of a Young Girl, and later on, The Diary of Anne Frank. That diary has been translated into over 60 languages and has sold over 30 million copies. And according to a Wikipedia list of best-selling books of all time, it's number 51, and this from a 15-year-old girl who probably didn't think her life had much meaning to people. She will be surprised someday. There's a photographer by the name of Vivian Meyer. She was actually a governess, a nanny, and she died basically destitute. She didn't have any heirs. But what people didn't know that about her was that during her spare time, she would go out in the streets of Chicago, take pictures of people. And after her death, there was an auction at a storage facility where she had stored all her rolls and rolls of undeveloped film, some prints and negatives. A man bought a box of them. He acquired 30,000 of them, and he started developing some of them, looking at them, and he saw how great they were. He was able to contact another person who had been at the auction and had bought some of the other ones, and he acquired almost all of them. There were over 100,000 of them altogether. He tracked down her obituary, found out who she was, and tried to find out a little bit about her. And he found that her name was Vivian Meyer. And now her photos are being exhibited all over the world. Her work was unknown during her lifetime, and she died nearly destitute. But a documentary and a film documentary have been written and made about her. And she died almost penniless, not knowing that any of this would happen. King Tut is another person. He didn't even attain the throne. He died when he was, I think it was 17. But he's famous because his tomb was one of the few intact tombs that was found. So people traveled there just to see the jewels, the gold and everything that was buried in his tomb. There's another class of people, late bloomers. And that could apply to any one of us. Maybe we just haven't reached our success point yet. J.K. Rowling was like that, or Colonel Sanders, Walt Disney. Grandma Moses, an artist who died in 1961 at age 101. Her paintings were famous all over the world. They were rather rustic and rather primitive in their look, but people liked them. And the interesting thing about her was she didn't start painting seriously until she was 78 years old. That means there's hope for me and for a lot of us here. I think, though, you have to have a little basic talent to start with. But it works the other way, too. There are many people who were very rich and very powerful, very famous in their lifetimes, that just aren't remembered today. There are people like, I can't remember any of them either, so... We don't. We forget about them. But as an example, you might think of lottery winners. You hear stories about them who win multiple millions of dollars in a lottery. They enjoy the high life for a while, but then in some cases, a couple years later, it's gone, and they have nothing to show for it. It could just as well have never happened. Well, I'd like to talk about some biblical examples, too. Searching online, I want to credit Stephen J. Cole was his name, and in the search I came up with something on Bible.org, and Stephen Cole talked about Jacob and Esau, comparing the two of them. And I think we remember the story about the twin brothers, how first Esau came out, and then afterwards his brother came out of the womb, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob, and that's translated as supplanter or deceiver. And the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And I'm quoting from Genesis 25, 27 and 28 there. As their story goes on, we find that Esau sells his birthright to his brother Jacob for a bowl of porridge, a bowl of stew. He gives up his birthright. And later, he's tricked out of his blessing. His father Isaac was old. He was nearly blind. He couldn't tell one boy from the other unless they got very close. But he sent his son Esau out to the field, told him to get some game, to bring it back, prepare it for his father, because his father liked the game that he prepared for him. But their mother, Rebekah, worked out a deception where she disguised Jacob, putting Esau's clothing on him and putting some animal hide on his hands to make them hairy like his brother's. And she fixed one of their own animals from their flock, and had him take that to his father. So his father thought this was Esau coming back early, but it wasn't. It was Jacob. And he couldn't tell the difference. He said, "Your voice sounds like Jacob, but your clothing, your hands, It feels like Esau, and you say you're Esau. And so he blessed him. And part of the blessing was, let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren. Let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you. And that was in Genesis 27, verses 28 and 29. He thought he was giving this blessing to Esau, but he was giving it to Jacob instead. Well, shortly after that, Esau returns. He got his game. He's prepared it for his father. He finds out what had happened while he was gone. And he said to his father, this is in verse 38 through 40 of Genesis 27, have you only one blessing, my father? Bless me also, my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck. And it says, so Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning are for my father are at hand. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. So it was a very tense situation between them. Jacob fled, went to his mother's brother Laban, and their lives went on. Jacob married Leah and Rachel, and eventually between them and their maids, he had 12 sons. Esau also took multiple wives, and they both became somewhat successful. But actually, Esau seemed to be the more successful of the two. After some time had passed, Jacob says, it's time to make peace with my brother Esau. And so first he sends peace offerings to his brother. He sends, he hears that Esau is coming with 400 men. So he sends peace offering in waves to his brother, jewels and animals from his flocks and so on. He's afraid that Esau is still going to kill him. But instead, Esau, when he sees him, he runs to meet him. He embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau said, and this is in Genesis 33, verse 8, Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Jacob was actually afraid of Esau because he had become somewhat powerful and rich at this time. And Jacob, not so much so. In Genesis 36, it tells the story of Esau. Genesis 36, verse 1. Now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. And it talks about his wives and about their sons, their daughters. And it says that Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. So Esau became the family of the Edomites. They had their own nation. They had their own family, their own tribe. And they had captured this land. And the chapter goes on to list all the chiefs and the genealogy of Edom. They were very wealthy at that time. Now contrast that to the next chapter, Genesis 37. Said, now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And it goes on to tell this history of Jacob. But they were still foreigners in their land. They were living there in someone else's land. So when you look at the two, Esau seems to be the successful one, and Jacob getting along, but not so much. And in fact, when they go to Egypt, it says in Genesis 46 and 26, all the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt, who came from his body, besides Jacob's sons, wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2 persons. All the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. Now, when you're talking about tribes and clans, 70 people is not very many. It doesn't say, or if it does say, I didn't pick up on it, how large Esau was, or Edom, their family. But we know that after Jacob's family got into Egypt, that they later multiplied until the Egyptians feared that they were going to overpower them. So their fame and their power came later. And it just wasn't the same physical power in that life that Edom had. And the author, Stephen J. Cole again, he points out that while Esau and Edom were powerful and successful by worldly standards, they were not so by God's standards. And that's a very important consideration. People successful in this life may not be successful in God's eyes. In the first message, we heard about Moses. I'd like to spend some time going through Moses' life. He was a reluctant leader. God called him to leadership and he resisted. Starting in Exodus 3, the Lord is speaking to Moses and he says in verse 9, "Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." Moses was very glad to hear that God heard the cry of the Israelites, that he realized how they were suffering, that they were being slaves, they were overworked. He was not so glad to hear that God was going to use him to bring them out of there. And he had a lot of excuses about why he wasn't the person to do it. He couldn't speak well, and what if the people don't believe me, and who shall I say is going to send me, and so on. Pharaoh rejected them. In fact, when Moses first came to them, to Pharaoh, and told him to let his people go, he just clamped down instead, and he said, "Okay, that's the way you want it. Now your people are going to have to get their own straw to make the bricks. And they're going to have to make as many as before." So he was causing more harm than good at first. And the people rejected him. But eventually, they go through the plagues, as we heard about earlier. They're finally allowed to leave Egypt, cross the Red Sea, and they're barely across before the people started complaining about this and that, and starting thinking back about how good it was in Egypt, all the food they had to eat, and so on. They conveniently forget all the slavery that they were under and the hard times. The people complained, but God answered. He provided manna, and it initially wasn't supposed to last for 40 years, but it did. God provided water for them. And it may be that God at some time here had this vision, this idealized vision of what it was going to be like. God had performed miracles to get them across the Red Sea. He performed miracles to provide manna and water. And just maybe Moses had this vision of God being with them, taking them all the way right to the promised land and into it, conquering the people, settling the Israelites there, and everything would be just fine. And if he did have this vision, that was something that would propel him forward. Unfortunately, it didn't happen that way, as we know. The people were quick to accept God's covenant. It says in Exodus 19, verses 7 and 8, "Moses came and called for the elders of the people, laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. And again, the people were willing to pay lip service, but when pressed to it, to actually perform, they didn't. They received the commandments. They had the Ark of the Covenant, instructions for building the tabernacle. And then when Moses was up on Mount Sinai, the people thought that he was up there longer than he should be in their eyes. And so they demanded of Aaron that he build this sacrifice, this golden calf. So Israel willfully broke the covenant, and God wanted to destroy them. But Moses interceded to save these people, and he atoned for them. They were punished by a plague, but God again told Moses to lead his people to the promised land. In Exodus 32, 34, and 5, "Now therefore go lead the people to the place of which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you." His life goes on. The tabernacle was built. They carried it with them. Every time they marched, they would disassemble it and then reassemble it when they got to the next leg of their journey. God provided quail. The people complained that they didn't have meat. They had the manna, but they wanted meat with it. So God provided quail for them. Aaron and Miriam, Moses' brother and his sister, rebelled against Moses. And Moses interceded for them. God wanted to punish them, but Moses interceded again. And finally they get to the promised land. And I can imagine Moses here thinking, well, we're here now. We can just go in and claim the land. God will help us, and we will do it. They send out a group of spies to spy it out, to find out what's there, what they're going to be up against, plan their strategy. But when the spies return, everyone except Joshua and Caleb were afraid to go in and claim it. They said, "They're too big for us. We can't do it." Joshua and Caleb said, "God is with us. Let's go in and do it." But they listened to the rest of them, and Israel rebelled against God. The people wanted to return to Egypt. Even after they had gotten this far, they wanted to go back. And God, again, wanted to destroy them and create a new nation from Moses. But Moses interceded again and asked him to spare the people, to go on with the original plan. So he spares the people, but he says that the older generation who saw these miracles in Egypt, none of them are going to see the promised land. You're going to wander for 40 years until all of them are dead. Well, it goes on. During the 40 years, Korah rebelled against Moses and Aaron, and an earthquake swallowed them up. Then all of Israel rebelled against Moses and Aaron. And finally, Moses himself sins. This is talked about in Numbers 20, verses 9 through 12. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. And he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" And Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. And water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." This was the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. So now Moses finds, well, first of all, they're not going to go there right away like he might have originally thought. He finds they're going to wander for 40 years, but at least he has this hope of bringing the younger generation across. And now he finds out that he himself will be allowed to see the land but not go into it. And during this time, Miriam died, his sister. Aaron dies. In Deuteronomy 33, Moses blessed all the tribes. And then in 34 of Deuteronomy, he's able to go up on Mount Nebo and look at the promised land. In Deuteronomy 34, this is in verses 1 through 8, Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the south, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as well as far as Zoar. Then the Lord said to him, "This is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'I will give it to your descendants.' I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there." So Moses, a servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And if you go to Jordan today, you can go up on Mount Nebo, and you can look approximately where Moses looked. Chances are pretty good you'll see a lot of smog, maybe rain and clouds, and you might not be able to see much of the promised land, but at that time, Moses was able to see it. He at least saw what they were going to inherit. And you might think that, well, at least I will have been successful in that regard, in that I will have seen them up here and know that they're going to go in and enter it. And how would he view his life at this time? Would he think himself as a success or not? There were a lot of things that went wrong between Egypt and the Promised Land. And one thing that might, depending on how you look at it, may have reassured Moses or may have made him feel very remorseful. Because in Deuteronomy 31, a few chapters before this, God told Moses what was going to happen. In Deuteronomy 31, verse 16, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, you will rest with your fathers, and this people will rise and play the harlot with the gods of the foreigners of the land, where they go to be among them, and they will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be aroused against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them.'" So even at that point, God tells them they're not going to succeed. And in a way, Moses could interpret this to mean that, well, this whole trip has been wasted. Why did it happen this way? But on the other hand, I think God is telling him that this is a very stubborn people that you're working with. You did everything you could. You interceded for them multiple times. You asked me to spare them, and I did. And it isn't your fault that they're going to fail. That's just the way the people are. And, of course, we know that God had larger plans in mind than what happened during that physical period that they lived through. But we hear in Deuteronomy 34, 10 and 12, how Moses has been evaluated. Deuteronomy 34, 10, "But since then there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. In all the signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, before Pharaoh, before all his servants and in all his land, and by all that mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel." So God is saying, there hasn't been anyone like him since then. And God knew him face to face. He wasn't a failure, not at all. He might have felt that many times. We can look at other examples too. We could consider Aaron. Aaron allowed the people to build the golden calf. Why did he yield to them? Why didn't he stand up to them? He might have been afraid. If you have everyone, seemingly everyone around you, screaming to build this calf, he might have worried what they would have done to him if he had said no. We don't know. He also rebelled against his brother Moses later on too. So he had his faults. David and Solomon, if we look through their lives, we can see so many sins going on. In many ways, their lives were very checkered, but still, we remember them ultimately as great people, even though they had many failures during their lives. We can think about people who may not have known how successful they were or would be. The widow who gave her two mites. She probably didn't think that she was anything special. She probably died feeling bad that she had been able to do so little with her life. All she could do was give two mites. Now, we don't know how often she did that or anything, but she would be very surprised to know that she's been a very positive example for people for over 2,000 years. And we don't know whether Christ or God is going to reveal who this person was or let her know that she was the one. But if he does, she is going to be amazed to hear what impact she had on people. Rahab the harlot is another one. We don't think of a harlot as being a very spiritual person necessarily, but she's written about in the Bible. She protected the spies at Jericho and saved them from being killed, and in return, she and her family were spared later. And her faith has been recorded as an example for us in Hebrews 11. So she is a success, at least in terms of faith. Well, I have three examination points as we try to evaluate our own lives and consider our own failures and successes. The first one is make sure that we use the right measuring stick. We can only evaluate our situation or progress by looking at the change in our own lives or by comparing our lives to that of Jesus Christ if we want some comparison. But if we try to compare our progress with anyone else, we'll always be able to find someone who's better, who seemingly is doing better than we are, or is better at whatever we want to achieve in our lives. We're warned in 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12, to not compare ourselves to other people. 2 Corinthians 10, 12 says, "For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise." And it goes on in verse 17 to say, "But he who glories, let him glory in the Lord. For not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends." So that's number one, make sure that we use the right measuring stick. Number two, we need to analyze what changes need to be made. Failure is going to happen, but we can't let it get in the way of our progress and our growth. We need to analyze what changes we need to make and go after the causes of the failure rather than just the effects. The UCG website has a lot of articles on both failure and success. And this was on a Beyond Today blog called Blame Someone, Anyone, from February 9th, 2008. And they're quoting here, they say, "A man can fail many times, but he isn't a failure until he begins to blame somebody else," said millionaire J. Paul Getty. The Bible tells us a righteous man falls seven times. That's in Proverbs 24:16. It is in the getting up that we develop determination, perseverance, courage, and skill. Failure, when properly understood, can become the stepping stone to success. And that passage is all quoted from that Beyond Today blog. We seem to learn or to like to blame someone else. We look for some other cause for our failure. And it may seem like the easy route to take, but in the end, we still have the same faults and flaws that cause the problems. So the first real step in improving our lives is to figure out what we're doing wrong and change ourselves, not blame someone else for it. So that's number two, analyze what changes need to be made. And number three, if you fall down, don't stay down. This is from another blog, Beyond Today, and this is from May 12, 2011, called A Fresh Start. And again, I'm quoting from this article. Mary Pickford, the silent film actress, was once quoted as saying, "If you have made mistakes, there's always another chance for you. You may have a fresh start any moment you choose. For this thing we call failure is not the falling down, but the staying down. Remember, a mistake is only a mistake if we refuse to learn from it." So that was number three. If you fall down, don't stay down. I mentioned they have many articles on the UCG website. When I did a search, I came up with a little over 1,000 results on failure and 1,770 on success. So you can look at either side of it and find a lot of material just on that website. And they are able to provide encouragement for any of our failures or anything we perceive as a failure. So to wrap everything up here, it's natural to find many shortcomings when we examine ourselves. And in fact, we wouldn't be doing an honest evaluation if we didn't see failures and areas that we need to work on or change. But that's no reason to be discouraged or give up. Success and failure cannot necessarily be determined in this lifetime. Many people, both in and outside of biblical accounts, who may have considered themselves to be failures, can in retrospect be considered great successes. That can be true to us, about us too. We need to look at ourselves through God's eyes and His standards, and to measure our progress and growth within ourselves rather than comparing ourselves to others. God is the judge, and He understands the situations that each of us face. He also notices the progress that we're making. We need to evaluate the cause of any failures, to learn from them, to make any necessary changes. Success and overcoming usually do not happen immediately, but only gradually over time. When we fall, when we fail, and it will happen, we need to keep going and learn from it. So with that, I want to wish everyone a good Passover and spring holiday season.